Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Intellectual Property Law Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, August 15, 2017, during a live teleforum conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's teleforum conference call, as today we speak with special guest, Acting Federal Trade Commission Chairman Maureen Olhausen. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome back to Teleforum two return guests. We're going to have an interview conducted by Mr. Alex Ocular. He's a partner at Orrick, Harrington, and Sutcliffe, and he'll be interviewing our guest, the Honorable Maureen K. Olhausen. She's acting chairman of the Federal Trade Commission. With that, Alex Ocular, the floor is yours.
Thanks so much, Dean. It's an honor to be here today, and I'm excited to talk to the acting chairman about patents and antitrust worldwide. Over the last several years, antitrust and IP practitioners have seen a dramatic rise in litigation involving patents, particularly those covering smartphone technology. As this patent litigation has expanded to touch nearly every major tech company in the sector, an international arms race of sorts has arisen, in which companies have assembled massive patent portfolios, and they've entered alliances with like-minded players. Many of the cases, perhaps even the majority, brought during this era have involved standard essential patents, or SEPs. Those are patents that have been voluntarily submitted to a standard-setting body, or SSO, under the assurance that if the technology became adopted as part of the standard, the patent owner would license that essential technology on reasonable and non-discriminatory terms. Among the recurring claims during this recent smartphone patent litigation was that certain SEP owners had engaged in holdup of standard technology implementers, either by seeking exorbitant terms or attempting to enjoin smartphone makers from practicing industry standards. Charged with protecting consumers, antitrust forcers in the U.S. and abroad have experienced a lot of pressure to do something. The U.S. Federal Trade Commission, or FTC, was among the agencies at the forefront of this activity. The FTC and other competition agencies responded aggressively, clamping down on perceived efforts by owners of RAND-encumbered SEPs to hold up standard implementers. They happened upon the rule that such patentees violate antitrust law if they try to enjoin a willing licensee, essentially a no-injunction rule. While that approach may have some intuitive appeal, questions have arisen, including whether this approach is consistent with core antitrust principles. Would this no-injunction rule properly consider whether the relevant conduct actually harms competition? And have the U.S. FTC's actions actually emboldened foreign competition agencies to act more aggressively, maybe even in a protectionist way? We are very fortunate today to have an esteemed guest, Acting FTC Chairman Maureen K. Olhausen, to help answer some of these questions and provide us with her insights, both as a Republican commissioner at the FTC in the minority from 2012 until early this year, as well as the acting chairman of the FTC leading the agency today. Let me take a minute to give the audience a brief background on the acting chairman. Maureen Olhausen was sworn in as a commissioner of the Federal Trade Commission on April 4, 2012, and was designated to serve as acting chairman by President Donald Trump in January 2017. Prior to joining the commission, she was a partner at Wilkinson Barker Knauer, where she focused on FTC issues, including privacy, data protection, and cybersecurity. She previously served at the commission for 11 years, most recently as director of the Office of Policy Planning from 2004 to 2008, where she led the FTC's Internet Access Task Force. She was also a deputy director of that office. From 1998 to 2001, she was an attorney advisor for former FTC Commissioner Orson Swindle, advising him on competition and consumer protection matters. She began at the FTC General Counsel's office in 1997. Before coming to the FTC, the acting chairman spent 5 years at the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit, serving as a law clerk for Judge David Sentell and as a staff attorney. She also clerked for Judge Robert Yauch of the U.S. Court of Federal Claims from 1991 to 92. She graduated with distinction from the Antonin Scalia Law School at George Mason University and graduated with honors from UVA. She was on the adjunct faculty at the law school, where she taught privacy law and unfair trade practices. She also served as a senior editor of the Antitrust Law Journal and a member of the ABA Task Force on Competition and Public Policy. She's authored a variety of articles on competition law, privacy, and technology matters. She's a true expert on these issues. So welcome, Acting Chairman. We appreciate you participating today and look forward to hearing your thoughts on these issues.
Great. Well, thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. And my thanks to Dean Werder and the Federalist Society for hosting, and to Alex O'Couliar for moderating this Intellectual Property Law Practice Group teleforum. So today I want to discuss intellectual property rights and competition policy. They are two foundational pillars of any effective innovation platform. And achieving the optimal blend of IP rights and antitrust rules is key to successful innovation. But there are many difficult questions that remain unanswered. So to start out, it's useful to revisit fundamental principles as we think about how to tailor innovation policy. And above all, property rights are the key to spurring R&D. Firms will devote capital to the costly process of invention only if they can reap the rewards of success. If their rivals can simply appropriate their technologies without payment, no rational company will invest in new products and methods that are vulnerable to copying. This point may seem obvious, but it's often overlooked. It can be tempting to assume that today's technologies were inevitable, and that diluting IP rights will simply lead to more competition and to lower prices. But that view is too limited, and scientific progress is costly, and it's not a given. So far from suppressing competition, property rights spur competition where it matters most, in new technologies. Firms that can't simply take others' technologies have to invent their own. And the results will be rich and varied innovation from a variety of sources that will ultimately bring fierce competition to product markets benefiting consumers. Now, I begin with those points because they provide context for the topic I'm going to address, which is antitrust limits on the use of standard essential patents, or SEPs, as Alex already explained to you. Standards play a critical role in the new economy. They foster interoperability, avoid costly wars between rival systems, and facilitate competition in product markets. Yet old questions governing property are emerging once again. In particular, when, if ever, should the law limit property rights to facilitate price competition? To get to the right outcome for competition, and most importantly, consumers, we must consider these questions very carefully. If policymakers go too far in limiting the rights of patentees who own standard essential technologies, I fear that reduced innovation will be the result. Now, holdup is the issue that has attracted most attention, particularly in the recent smartphone wars. The conventional narrative is that when firms commit to a standard, they can no longer look to alternative technologies that were previously available. And a patent holder's bargaining power may therefore surge after industry adopts an infringing standard, potentially allowing SEP holders to demand outsized royalties. And armed with an injunction, the thinking goes, a SEP owner can threaten all revenue flowing from the standard. And the patent holder could then extract more than the competitive price, which would reflect the marginal value of the patent holder's technology to the standard as compared to the alternative technologies that were available at the time the standard was set. So given this kind of theoretical background, it's no concern then that some policymakers have taken a dim view of SEP holders' efforts to enjoin firms from practicing mandatory industry standards. Indeed, competition authorities around the world have considered whether to prohibit a SEP owner, which has promised a standard-setting organization, typically called an SSO, that it will license its essential technologies on reasonable and non-discriminatory, or RAND, terms, from seeking to enjoin a willing licensee. Indeed, the FTC during the Obama administration used its Section 5 Unfair Methods of Competition Authority to challenge owners of RAND-encumbered SEPs that tried to enjoin willing licensees. And antitrust agencies around the world have taken similar steps. Now, these global developments point to increasingly onerous limits on SEP owners' ability to assert their rights, and it suggests that these agencies are adopting a categorical rule. If you agree to license on RAND terms, you may not try to enjoin a willing licensee using a SEP. But I think such absolutes are seldom correct, and I don't think that's any different here. The no injunction rule overlooks complications that ought to give us pause. The prohibition is overbroad and snares conduct that doesn't harm competition and also potentially suppresses innovation. And given the complexity of these issues, a quasi-per se rule misses the mark. So the U.S. Supreme Court has explained that resort to per se rules is confined to restraints that would always or almost always tend to restrict competition and decrease output. And only restraints that lack any redeeming virtue warrant per se prohibition. Thus, in the U.S., we have stepped away from misplaced per se rules against things like vertical price and market restraints, and abandoned the erroneous assumption that a patent always confers market power. And it's my view that requested injunctive relief by RAND Limited CEP owners, even directed at so-called willing licensees, likewise doesn't justify summary condemnation. Now, I'm not saying that there is no potential for anti-competitive holdup, although I think there's little real-life evidence of it, but rather noting that pro-competitive justifications can exist. And the FTC's recent experience counsels against dogmatic rules and in favor of flexibility. So, for example, in investigating the acquisition of SPX Service Solutions by Bosch, the FTC learned that SPX had previously used patents to try to enjoin willing licensees. And in a 2013 settlement, the FTC required that Bosch license certain of its patents, which may or may not have been standard essential, on a royalty-free basis, and that Bosch agree not to seek injunctive relief against standard implementers. But just 3 months later, the FTC backed off this approach in a settlement with Google MMI, and it didn't require Google to license Motorola Mobility's previously asserted SEPs royalty-free. Nor did the FTC deny Google the possibility of injunctive relief. And to the contrary, Google could move to enjoin a standard implementer that it did not commit to license on RAND terms as determined through arbitration or an action in district court, so they needed to go through that process. Now, lessons drawn from the U.S. experience and from case law governing per se prohibitions counsels a flexible standard rather than a firm pro se prohibition. Policymakers should not presume that seeking an injunction is always problematic, even against firms that agree to respect a third party's determined royalty. And competition agencies should examine the facts of each case before reaching a conclusion. So I think there's really more than meets the eye when we're talking about injunctions and willing licensees. But first, to be clear, I want to be clear that I support antitrust oversight of the standard-setting process. Patentees involved in a standard setting can harm competition. So, for example, eliminating a price constraint imposed by a substitute technology would injure competition in an upstream technology market. Thus, if multiple technologies compete for inclusion in a standard and a firm conceals its patents, or falsely promises to license on RAND terms, then an antitrust claim may be justified if the standard-setting organization chooses the patentee's technology as a result of that deception, and if the SEP owner subsequently holds up firms that implement the standard. And the FTC has brought several cases based on this fact pattern of deception. Competitive harm could also result in the product market if the SEP owner competes there and uses economic power derived from its monopolization of the upstream market to raise rivals' costs downstream. So there's clearly a role for competition law. My concern is that policymakers may, in some cases, be using competition policy in a way that exceeds what antitrust law is supposed to do. Antitrust protects competition. It doesn't regulate prices. And the modern trend toward categorical condemnation is in tension with that fundamental principle. So increasingly, it appears that the owner of a RAND-encumbered SEP may not lawfully try to enjoin a standard implementer that refuses to pay the patent holder's demanded price and instead chooses to litigate. But not every case harms such case like that harms competition. And a ban on injunctions may sometimes harm consumers. So instead, it would be better to scrutinize each case of alleged holdup on its own facts. So let me give a few examples of what I'm thinking about. So first, consider a groundbreaking pioneer technology that every firm and industry wants to use in its next generation products. Such a patent may be essential even before the standard is set, meaning that the relevant SSO could not create the industry's desired standard without including that patent holder's new technology. In that situation, we would expect technology users to pay the monopoly price, compensating the patent holder appropriately for its revolutionary invention and fostering incentives to invent further such revolutionary technology. So in other words, for such a standout technology, a reasonable royalty is the monopoly price. In such cases, there can be no harm to upstream competition because there are no substitutes to foreclose. So holdup may not be possible because the SEP holder's market power before the standard is set could equal its market power with the standard. Yet the way the policy winds are blowing suggests that such a SEP owner could not enjoin an arguably willing licensee without violating antitrust law. But I think antitrust liability here would be unprincipled. Antitrust enforcement should focus on actions that injure competition. And also, such enforcement could be counterproductive. It would undercompensate owners of the most valuable technologies, those that standard-setting organizations had to include in the relevant standard because of the importance of the invention. Now, some commentators argue that damages are always enough, and so there's no need for an injunction. Having agreed to license on RAND terms, the inventor of an essential technology could just sue for reasonable royalty and thereby avoid irreparable injury. And while this may be true in some cases, it's not necessarily always true. The problem lies in technology users' resulting incentives. Prospective licensees of key technologies gain nothing by paying the monopoly price up front. If they can use a willing licensee framework recognized by any trust enforcers without fear of being on the receiving end of an injunction. So faced with paying the monopoly price, they would rationally play the regulator's game, and they would go through the motions of the back-and-forth negotiation before swiveling to a protracted dispute resolution process by which a court or arbitrator identifies a reasonable price. And unable to threaten an injunction, the law would force the SEP owner to pay litigation costs and forego immediate licensing revenue. And as a result, the law may deny owners of the most valuable technologies their full compensation, diluting their incentives to invent and the incentives of any other inventors. Now, that outcome would be especially perverse because core innovations are the most important ones to encourage. And facing that prospect, inventors of cutting-edge technologies may simply choose not to participate in the standard-setting process to avoid encumbering their critical technologies with the RAND commitment. And we should also recognize what the no injunction rule here ultimately entails. Compulsory licensing of proprietary technologies, qualified only by a patentee's willingness to offer a RAND licensing promise. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court has never recognized an essential facilities doctrine, and its recent jurisprudence wisely pours cold water on the virtues of forced sharing. And that jurisprudence exists for a good reason. As the U.S. Supreme Court has explained, compelling such firms to share the source of their advantage is in some tension with the underlying purpose of antitrust law, since it may lessen the incentive for the monopolist, the rival, or both to invest in those economically beneficial facilities. Enforced sharing also requires antitrust courts to act as central planners, identifying the proper price, quantity, and other terms of dealing, a role for which they're ill-suited. Now, there are other problems with condemning a SEP owner just for seeking an injunction. So absent deception or other misconduct that caused the SSO to adopt a firm's patented technology over an alternative, a SEP holder's enhanced power in licensing its technology comes from third parties' lock-in, not from its own conduct. If a SEP owner harms competition by requesting an injunction, then the injury has to lie in the downstream product market, not at the IP licensing level. Now, some policymakers have argued that the mere threat of injunction can distort competition by giving the patent holder greater leverage in negotiations over a fair royalty. And maybe that's true in some cases, but it's not always true. So seeking to enjoin a technology user could harm downstream competition only if three conditions are satisfied. First, the court actually grants the requested injunction, or there's a material probability that it'll do so. Second, the patentee or its proxy competes in the product market. And third, the patentee has sufficient power in that market. And those conditions do not always hold. So in the first place, the court may find that the asserted patent is invalid or not infringed, which is a fairly frequent occurrence in the U.S. Even if the patent holder shows that its patent is indeed standard essential, the court may still deny injunctive relief and award a reasonable royalty. As we know, in the U.S., the law doesn't automatically award prevailing patent holders injunctive relief. And unless an accused infringer unilaterally refuses a RAND royalty or unreasonably delays negotiations, it seems unlikely that court will grant injunctions to SEP owners who have given RAND licensing assurances. So, and thus far, we've seen that to be the case. Injunctions are hardly ever granted here. So generally, then, competition in the product market will continue undisturbed even if a SEP owner asks for an injunction. Second, if the SEP owner or an entity that controls the SEP owner does not compete in the product market, it can't monopolize that market under the Sherman Act. In other situations, the SEP holder may compete in the product market but lack the market power needed to violate the antitrust law. And perhaps the patent's valid but may only infringe an optional feature of the standard. Also, this, as I mentioned, the SEP owner may lack sufficient market power in that. So separately, the patent holder may have a fringe position in the product market, and the scope of its requested injunction may be too narrow to harm competition. And further, even if a patent is essential to practicing a particular standard, there may be competing standards within an industry that deprive the patent holder of monopoly power. And even if a standard is mandatory, a SEP owner may be one of many seeking to monetize its proprietary technology. And competing claims to revenue generated by a standard could limit that SEP owner's ability to raise price and should also then be taken into account in a proper antitrust analysis. Now, this is just an example of the issues that could arise to suggest that anti-competitive effect won't occur. But, of course, these details won't exist in every case. But my point is that any or all of them could arise and that the no injunction rule doesn't take them into account. So there are therefore many circumstances in which a SEP owner can't harm competition and hence can't violate antitrust law in seeking to enjoin a willing licensee. More importantly, there are cases in which denying a SEP holder injunctive relief will harm dynamic efficiency and dissuade participation in the standard setting process. And to date, I don't think agency action has sufficiently addressed these complications. Ultimately, the antitrust case against efforts to enjoin a willing licensee using a RAND encumbered SEP may be strong or weak, depending on the specific facts of the situation at hand. And therefore, antitrust enforcers should scrutinize each case on its own merits. So all told, even if a requested injunction violates a RAND licensing guarantee, it's not always an antitrust problem. Rather, these issues sound in contract law, as litigants and courts have recognized. And I submit that antitrust agencies should focus on conduct that actually harms the competitive process, as when a patent holder's deception before an SSO causes the adoption of proprietary technology over a substitute technology, followed by holdup. Injunctions in violation of contractual promises, however, are generally matters to be resolved using conventional breach of contract principles. So in conclusion, I hope some of you at least will agree that the issues surrounding injunctions in the standard setting arena are more complex than is often supposed. Today's common wisdom is that a SEP owner who has promised to license on RAND terms should never try to enjoin a potentially willing licensee. And that position is understandable and seems intuitive. After all, a patent holder can potentially use an injunction to extract royalties exceeding its technical contribution to a standard. Yet despite all the good intentions, a strict no injunction rule omits critical nuances. Above all, it deprives SEP holders of injunctive relief against arguably willing licensees and may undercompensate those who invent the most valuable technologies, and that's a serious problem. Now, the no injunction rule would still be defensible if the administrative costs of distinguishing pro and anti-competitive conduct were high, but competition agencies are very capable of investigating each case on its facts to weigh allegations of holdup and the potential for holdout. And overbroad rules inevitably result in false positives, which we shouldn't accept if we don't absolutely need to. So this all leads me back to my most important point. Diluting property rights harms innovation. Technological progress is a critical driver of long-term economic growth. If domestic innovation is to flourish, then the law must instill appropriate incentives. Firms won't invest large amounts of money in R&D if they can't protect their technological inventions from appropriation. And that principle is straightforward, but it's the foundation of patent systems around the world that have overseen unprecedented technological advance. And I have another paper on that, too. But as economies become increasingly knowledge-based, optimal innovation policy has to evolve in turn. So in that regard, I'll return to industry standards. As they become ubiquitous and account for a larger share of technology, standards require tailored patent and antitrust policies. Now, holdup is a potential concern for which competition enforcers should be on guard. But holdup's not the only danger, and recent enforcement actions and narratives obscure an equally serious concern, which is holdout. CEP holders that acquire market power via anti-competitive conduct before an SSO and use that use injunctions to hold up technology users should face antitrust scrutiny. But equally, the law should not undercompensate owners of critical technologies by allowing any infringer that adopts the mantle of a willing licensee to delay compensation via holdout. So thank you for listening, and I look forward to the discussion.
Thank you so much, Acting Chairman. You discussed many of these issues in a recent article in the Stanford Technology Law Review, which is called The Elusive Role of Competition in the Standard-Setting Antitrust Debate. In that article, as well as in your remarks today, you talk about Section 5 of the FTC Act, which prohibits unfair methods of competition. For those on the line that might not be familiar with it, what is Section 5, and how does it actually differ from the U.S. antitrust laws, if at all?
Yeah, so Section 5 of the FTC Act declares unfair methods of competition in or affecting commerce to be unlawful. So the way we've interpreted that is that anything that violates the Sherman Act would also violate Section 5's prohibition on unfair methods of competition. But the question that's arisen is whether there is behavior that the Sherman Act can't reach that Section 5 unfair methods could reach. And I personally am very concerned about that. I think that we shouldn't be trying to expand much beyond the borders of the Sherman Act to reach problematic conduct. So one of my particular concerns in this space is that the FTC has relied on this broader interpretation of unfair methods of competition to challenge attempts to of patent holders to vindicate their rights through seeking an injunction or an exclusion order before the ITC. And they haven't really grappled with the issue of whether the behavior harms competition rather than just annoying or harming a particular competitor. And I think that's where the real nub is here, and one of the concerns is whether the FTC is saying, we can use Section 5 to reach conduct that we just find unpleasant or distasteful, or that we have some concern might possibly, you know, raise price down the road, without saying, well, does it actually harm competition? And I think that that's one of the things, as I went through my article and hoped I gave a, you know, kind of an overview of here, is we really need to say, well, what is the competition that's being harmed by this kind of behavior? Was it competition in the upstream market to be the IP, the patent that was chosen as the standard, or are there competitors being harmed in the downstream market? Because I think way too often the way this has been approached is to say, we think it's just sort of better if the patent holder doesn't seek an injunction, so therefore we're going to say it's unfair somehow under broader Section 5, even if we can't say it violates the Sherman Act because we can't say that it harms competition in a particular market.
It sounds like in part what you're saying is that adopting a broader view of Section 5 as a source of enforcement authority could lead to more arbitrary enforcement or overreach. And in your remarks today, you also noted that the government has overreached in enforcing FRAND commitments on SEPs. Can you walk us through some particularly instructive examples of where you think that the government has overreached, and to what extent was Section 5 the vehicle for that, if at all?
Right. So one of the problems with this overbroad interpretation of Section 5 is saying that it covers conduct that contravenes the spirit of the antitrust laws, or which in certain circumstances, if allowed to mature, could violate the antitrust laws. But we're not saying, well, does it cause harm right now? And so the two cases that I would point to during my tenure is the Bosch case, which I discussed, where really in terms of a merger review, so not a conduct case, but a merger review, the FTC majority said, oh, we think this company may have sought an injunction on standard essential patents. So therefore, they have to promise to license those patents going forward on a royalty-free basis and not seek an injunction. And then in Google, the Google MMI case, which had to do with a licensing dispute between Apple and Google-owned MMI's Motorola Mobility's patents, that raised an issue where a district court had even found that Apple wasn't a willing licensee, right? So the court said they weren't willing to, you know, to pay a reasonable royalty, a brand royalty. But somehow the FTC stepped in and said, that's an antitrust violation, or excuse me, a Section 5 violation. So I think those were some of the two most troubling acts that the FTC has undertaken without delving into this broader analysis to say, were these competitors? In what market did they compete? What was the impact on competition? Kind of doing a rule of reason analysis. They just kind of jumped to the idea that we thought they should have, not sought an injunction. Therefore, there's some kind of harm to competition without really parsing that through. And that's to say nothing of the Norr-Pennington doctrine that gives, you know, constitutional protection to the right to petition the government, which is something that, you know, courts have also recognized in this space.
And you mentioned concepts like hold up as driving some of the enforcement activity. You also mentioned hold out on the other side. Are there any prominent examples of hold up or hold out in or reverse hold up in any of the marketplaces that you've looked at?
So there's been a lot of theoretical discussions about hold up, but I haven't seen any real examples of it occurring. So I would point you and folks on the line to a comment that I filed along with my then colleague, Commissioner Wright, before the International Trade Commission in July of 2015, and we talked about this issue, and we pointed out there was really a lack of empirical support for hold up actually occurring in the marketplace. There are theoretical concerns, and we have seen, I think, examples of hold out occurring. So, for example, the ITC found that Apple was holding out against Samsung in a licensing dispute. Now, their determination was eventually overruled by the U.S. Trade Representative, but they did do a very deep dive into what had actually gone on in the licensing negotiations, and the ITC found that there had been Apple wasn't a willing licensee. I haven't found a lot of evidence that hold out is actually occurring, and there are some instances that hold up is actually occurring. But I think there have been some instances of hold out. Now, some people would argue merely the fact that RAND provisions or FRAND provisions are in standard-setting organization obligations suggests that, you know, hold up is rampant, right? That's why these provisions are there, because we're so concerned about it happening. But again, that's sort of, you know, the question is, well, is it happening so much, and is it actually an antitrust violation that it's, you know, actually impacting competition in a particular product market between particular competitors, rather than is it a theoretical possibility? I mean, my view is everyone can act opportunistically, and we should be alert for that. But not every opportunistic activity is an antitrust violation.
Well, thank you. So it sounds like that you're not really seeing that many examples of hold up. There may be some, but you're not seeing them, and they're not a terribly large number of examples of hold out, although you are seeing some of those, I think you noted. You mentioned willing licensees a few times, and you mentioned that there have been courts that have looked at willing licensee and made attempts to define it. You know, can you give us a little bit of detail on some of the factors that courts have considered when attempting to define willing licensees?
Well, some of the factors that, you know, I believe the ITC looked at have to do with, you know, was there, you know, a genuine attempt to engage on negotiations for the royalty rate, or was there just a sort of never sending the right person to the negotiation, long delays in responding, just sort of delay, yeah, kinds of things. And then, you know, when I mentioned the Apple case, Apple versus Motorola Mobility, where the court found that Apple basically said, well, we will, even if the court determines a FRAND rate, they didn't agree to be bound by it, right? So I mean, I think there's, I'm not expecting that, you know, each side should always, you know, immediately come to like an agreement that, you know, 45 cents is the right price. But a failure to even talk about it, to even engage, to say, even if court determines this, we're not going to adhere to that. We'll only adhere to it if we like it. I think that starts to point in the direction of someone not being a willing licensee. I mean, there are a lot of disputes going on now about what is a FRAND rate, and there's, you know, there's a lot of different views on that and ways to calculate that. But if companies are actually at least agreeing to talk about it and being in the ballpark, that may be more of an indicator that they are being a willing licensee versus someone saying, you know, never getting back to you or saying, I won't agree to even if a court decision on the amount.
Mm-hmm. So it seems like it's a fact-intensive analysis at this point to determine whether there is, I guess, genuine negotiation going on or whether the potential licensee is engaging in effectively a sham. Is that a fair summary of where things stand?
Yes, I think so. And that's really been one of sort of my points here is this is not an area where per se rules are appropriate. This is a rule of, you know, a very classic rule of reason kind of analysis that we should be using. And my big concern is, you know, the FTC has kind of adopted a practically a no injunction rule with a few limits. And around the world, that seems to be strongly the trend, and even more so the trend where we're seeing, you know, IP licensing guidelines in other countries that say, if you have really important technology, we're going to take it into the standard, and then you couple that with an unfair pricing prohibition, and you're getting to, you know, appropriation of technology at a you know, government-favored rate, basically, and particularly in countries where you have state-owned enterprises, that's very troubling mix of things.
And if it were entirely up to you, are there additional things that you would change about the willing licensee definition or approach that courts or other agencies have engaged in? In other words, how would you define a willing licensee?
Well, I mean, one thing is it's not so much how I would define a willing licensee as the fact that I think courts and the ITC are very well positioned to look at these disputes, right? And that was one of my biggest complaints about what the FTC was doing, is we were cutting them out of the process. We said, if you are the patent holder and you go ask the ITC or you go ask a court to, you know, enjoin or to get an exclusion order because you think the person is not a willing licensee, you're going to be sued under Section 5 of the FTC Act. So we totally cut out of the discussion the entities that are in a much better position to determine who is a willing licensee and who isn't. Not to punch on that question, but just to say I don't think the antitrust agency was sort of on a per se, practically a per se basis, was ready to say, we know who is a willing licensee and who isn't. I think it's a much more factual determination that others are probably better placed to make in the first instance.
So, shifting gears for a second to discuss standard setting bodies more generally, is the business of standard setting bodies? So that is, competitors in large part, or maybe we could say market participants, getting together and agreeing on a course of industry conduct. Is that business potentially anti-competitive in and of itself, such that it would warrant some type of heightened scrutiny by antitrust authorities? And how should the conduct of those bodies be evaluated from your perspective?
Well, whenever a group of competitors gets together to discuss things, even if they're conversations are supposed to be about entirely legal topics like, jointly petitioning the government, there's always a heightened concern that it could spill over into other more problematic topics and that they may be, deciding to do something that's anti-competitive. But putting that kind of practical, we're always on a little bit of a heightened alert whenever competitors are getting together to talk about how they might compete. I don't think standard-setting organizations on their own should be subject to any more of a heightened antitrust scrutiny just for trying to set industry standards. Standard-setting has been shown to provide incredibly important benefits to to consumers and to innovation. And I think it's really generally pro-competitive. And I don't want to chill the ability of firms to create common technical standards through overly aggressive antitrust enforcement, and which is my respect for the value that standards bring also is kind of what drives a lot of my concerns about saying, well, if you have a really valuable technology, if you put it into a standard, you're also agreeing that you can never get an injunction, even if somebody is not a willing licensee. I'm afraid that will undermine standard setting, and some entities have already raised that concern as occurring, given the enforcement that the FTC has done. So it's not that I think standard setting organizations themselves are so problematic. I think they are generally pro-competitive. But just sort of the normal level of scrutiny we should give to possible competitors getting together to set the terms.
Well, thank you very much. Dean, I think we are at a point where we may want to open the line to see if there are audience questions.
Very good. Happy to do so. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question for our guest, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, our lines are wide open. If you have a question for Acting Chairman Maureen Olhausen, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let me make a quick announcement about our upcoming schedule as we wait to see if anybody rings in here. Tomorrow, as our next scheduled Teleforum conference call, we'll be discussing how Christians are faring in the Middle East. As of right now, we don't have a Teleforum scheduled on Thursday, but then Friday at noon, we'll be back on patents looking at the PTAB through the lens of our regulatory transparency project. Again, today, Acting Chairman Maureen Olhausen, push the star button and then the pound button if you have a question. Let me see if I can get things started. I'm not quite a member of the audience, but I'm more an observer here than a participant. So, You mentioned Acting Chairman Olhausen in your opening remarks. I think you laid out very well the importance of innovation and how patents help drive innovation and drive the economy. And then when you're talking about holdup, I'm not an expert in this area, but you mentioned a lack of empirical evidence and the fact that it's holdup is sort of a theory more than a proven occurrence, at least in the way businesses are running today. I'm just wondering if there are any examples of regulatory regimes being imposed on the business community in an area as critical as innovation, as you've described it, based on sort of theory only to the exclusion of empirics. Is that a common occurrence, or can you speak to that?
Well, I mean, I think it's almost like there are fads that run through antitrust. And at times, you know, it seems that saying, well, we see that there could be, you know, some sort of bad effect from seeking an injunction, and it kind of goes around the world, and all these other agencies kind of jump on board. Sorry about the siren going by. To say, oh, this must be an antitrust action. We actually saw this happen in patent assertion entities too, right? So there's this big argument that patent assertion entities were causing all these problems, and so you know, the FTC took a look at it. And did a study, but you know, empirical evidence is really important. And one of the things that I've run into in this space more broadly is an argument that our belief that property rights and that intellectual property rights leads to innovation is just faith-based, that there's no evidence for that. And so I thought, well, I'm going to take a look and see whether there is evidence for that. And so I have an article in the Harvard Journal of Law and Technology called Patent Rights in a Climate of Intellectual Property Rights Skepticism, where I reviewed all the studies I could get my hands on to say, is there a connection? Is there a correlation? You can't really prove causation, but is there at least a strong connection or correlation between a country that provides strong IP protection and innovation? And I found that there was. And that you could see these changes over time as IP rights got stronger or weaker. I measured innovation by measuring investments in R&D, that it did change companies' incentives to invest in new, you know, new forms of innovation. It's stronger in some industries than others. You know, pharmaceuticals, it was very strong. It's kind of, you know, but it's not unimportant in any industry. And so I think that, you know, kind of these theories that get sort of like popular and taken up without kind of looking at what's the empirics behind it, that's always concerning for me.
And unless we have additional questions coming in, Dean, I was hoping to ask Acting Chairman, you mentioned a few times that other jurisdictions are looking at these same issues. You know, how are you seeing these issues play out in other jurisdictions, and which ones are sort of the leading jurisdictions in terms of looking at these matters?
So, sure. Some of the biggest concerns I've seen are in Asia, particularly in China, where we're seeing the idea that you've asserted your IP right against a competitor, and therefore that's, you know, an antitrust violation, and you're going to be subject to, you know, all kinds of penalties. So the case-by-case enforcement is problematic. But even more concerning for me are the IP licensing guidelines that are being considered in China, where in some cases they're saying, if you have really important technology, we are going to take you, even if you didn't participate in the standard setting organization, we're going to take it as part of the standard. And then you couple that with prohibition on unfair pricing, then you're saying, yes, and we're going to tell you that you're charging too much for that. So even if you didn't want to share your property, I mean, the right to exclude is at the heart of property rights, and including intellectual property rights. And this is being undermined with the idea that your IP is valuable, so we're going to say everyone should be able to practice it, because we're going to take it in as part of a standard, whether you wanted to participate in the standard or not. And then we're going to say what the price is that we think is a good price. And when you mix that up with a country that has state-owned enterprises that want to manufacture, phones or what have you, using this IP, I think that's a very troubling development. And unfortunately, what we've done in the U.S. using unfair methods of competition has been read in these other places as a justification for going that step further and saying, well, we're not looking at whether you made a promise to license this on a certain term. We're just saying that's really valuable IP. We want our companies to have access to it at a price that we consider, quote, fair.
As markets like China's become more of an innovation-based market, do you see their position on these types of issues changing at all within the government?
I hope that will happen, right? They are very interested in sort of moving from just a manufacturing economy to an innovation economy. So they do want to move to having more valuable IP created in their own country, to be more of an inventor economy, not just an implementer economy. But not all the arrows are pointing in the same direction on that, right? So, and also, to rely on an even-handed application, depending on whether you are a foreign company owning the IP or you're an indigenous company owning the IP, that's another challenge there. So you could still end up with something where you're saying, well, this guy was unfair, but, this guy who we know knows they weren't charging, unreasonable rate. They were meeting their FRAND terms. So anyway, I think there's, points that we can make with China about how it's in their interest to protect IP rights more generally. Even in the antitrust realm, I mean, obviously there's a lot of discussion right now with what the administration is doing on trade issues and kind of even putting that aside. But my concern is that I've seen what we've done in the U.S. being used as justification for, basically appropriating technology on terms that are favorable to indigenous interests.
Thank you. Dean, are there any audience questions at this point? If not, I have another question that I would ask.
We don't have any questions pending. Let me announce once again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. But I will interject, Alex, if I see a question. Go right ahead.
Oh, thanks. So, Acting Chairman, given your experience, you've alluded to the fact that this type of an enforcement environment can discount or harm the value of intellectual property that's been submitted to a standard-setting body and become a SEP. Have you seen any evidence that there has been a diminution in the value of SEPs generally, or I think you mentioned earlier that there may have been a diminution in interest in participating in SSOs? What's the situation there?
Yeah, I've heard from companies that are IP inventors that they are pulling back from participating in certain standard-setting organizations because of they don't like the new terms that are being adopted, kind of somewhat under strong encouragement by the previous administration for these SSOs to adopt and to have rules that greatly limit the ability for a patent owner to try to vindicate its rights to get paid, a reasonable royalty. So I certainly have seen that, and I think that there's a lot of battling going on right now over IP, and I think that. As people look down the road, what do they want to invest in, right? They can invest in, something that, involves IP, inventing IP, or something that doesn't. And if it seems like it's getting just too difficult to get your, reasonable rate of return, your investment back from something that's, IP intensive, where you have to invest a lot, I think rational, you know, businesses will turn away from that. Which is certainly kind of goes back to the Harvard article that I was talking about. Do, you know, if IP rights are strongly protected, do companies invest in R&D? The answer is yes. And then if they're not strongly protected, do they turn away from investing in R&D? The answer seems to be yes as well.
Thank you so much, Acting Chairman. I think we are almost at a close of our time here. Do you have any final remarks that you'd like to share with us?
Well, no, I just thank everybody, you know, for listening. I think these are important issues, and I just encourage, this is such an important area for our economy and for innovation, for economic growth, to not kind of jump to the easy answer of saying, oh, wouldn't it be better if this company, you know, licensed that company and, you know, we all got our, you know, our devices more cheaply today without, so that's static, right? We need to look at dynamic effects and dynamic efficiency, and we need to be rigorous about what is antitrust about. Antitrust is not a price regulator. It doesn't say the best outcome is I get whatever I want for the lowest price. What we trust in is that market competition will, over the long term, provide the most innovation, the most, the best mix of quality, price, convenience, you know, all the factors that are important to consumers, and that we really need to then do a rigorous analysis of saying, well, are these competitors? What market is being foreclosed? And then, kind of, what's the long term impact on investment and innovation from where we're drawing these lines?
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Dean, I think that is all for us.
Well, I want to thank both Alex Ocular and Acting Chairman Maureen Olhausen of the FTC for their participation today as return guests to Teleforum. Certainly appreciate your time. Also, thanks to the audience for being with us and for dialing in. A reminder that our next scheduled Teleforum conference call is tomorrow at 2 p.m. at this same number. We'll be talking about how Christians are faring in the Middle East. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.